Good morning, Trinity Covenant Church, all those that are joining us live stream. Our hope really in prayer is that as you sit around the TV or devices, whatever you are doing, that you understand and know that God is with you, He is for you, and He absolutely adores and loves you. And maybe you need to hear words that we were singing a minute ago, because maybe before we even get into God's word, your head needs to be centered on something. Maybe you need to hear the words from the song Waymaker that says, even when I don't see it, He's working. Even when I don't feel it, He's working. Center yourself on the chaotic nature of your lives this last week, less last month, and say, God, even when I don't see it or feel it, You're working. You never stop. You never stop working. These last couple of days, my wife and I have been working to get our yard ready. Spring is here. It's sprung in my house. And one of the things that we're really getting ready are our vegetable gardens. And this is new for us. In Texas, we didn't do any vegetable gardens because it's really hot. Water's really expensive. We don't get a lot of rain. But when we moved to Connecticut, people were talking about these vegetable gardens that they grow and how it's really delicious. And we were intrigued. So we jumped for it. And we went in with not a lot of thought and ideas, but we just ran with it. And we started to make huge mistakes. We started with not really putting it in the greatest place for light. We didn't really pick good soil. We just kind of got some of the cheapest stuff and thought, hey, it's soil. It'll work, right? And we didn't think about all the structures and support it needed while growing. And all of a sudden, it just was a mess. It was just a mess. Like the harvest was bad because we had made really bad decisions. And then we learned. We were like, okay, we're going to do this again, but we're going to learn. And so we took all the things that we did wrong and we started to make things different. We built some raised beds. We cleared some path where there's a lot of sun, good access to water. We put really good soil in it. We started and created support and distance and structures for all of these gardens, and the harvest was good. I've never tasted vegetables that I don't usually like that tasted so good and was so delicious. And it really was a tale of two gardens. It was a tale of a garden that really made bad decisions and bad harvest, and then a garden last year that actually was really good because we made really good decisions and we had a really great harvest. And see, that's the reality of where we're sitting in when we get to this text in Matthew 26, that it's not a standalone Jesus is in the garden with his disciples. Standing alone, he's in the garden with his disciples because he's sitting there and comparing his moment, Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane versus the Garden of Eden. And it really is a tale of not just Jesus in his prayer, but Jesus in a tale of two gardens, that what was wrong and bad decisions has now been starting to be made right by the good decisions. And so we want you to jump in with us. Jump in with us in Matthew 26. And so I want to read that for you really quick as we center in kind of where we are in the text and what we're going to be looking at. And it says this. Going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." And then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Couldn't you men keep watch with me for 1 hour?" Peter asked. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is so weak." He went away a second time and he prayed, "My Father, if it is possible for this cup to be taken away, unless I drink it, may your will be done." So as we dive deep today into this text in Matthew 26, we're going to be going between Matthew 26 and Genesis 3, looking at both experiences within the garden. We look at really the tale of two gardens, the Garden of Eden and the Garden of Gethsemane, and we see really what is unfolding in this text is three things, that really the trajectory of life is changed, that life and how we know it and who we are and what our purpose is drastically changed in those two gardens. And also, The battle of the will is expressed differently in the Garden of Eden and the Garden of Gethsemane. And so we're gonna look in and then jump in at those places. And the reality is that history, all of history was changed in the gardens, all of it. The trajectory of everything that we were known as human beings and where we were going changed between these two gardens. In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, in the most beautiful place in all of human history that I've ever seen, any picture that you can see, like, oh, that's so beautiful, didn't hold a candle to this garden, nothing. And they messed it all up. They lit a match, threw it on the fire, and burnt the whole place down because their decision led humans not into this beautiful relationship with God who had created them, that knew them and walked with them, and that was going to be with them forever. They made a bad decision, which then literally brought sin, death, and separation into their lives. It was in that place of their decisions. Their decisions didn't bring life, but it took life. See, we have been dealing with that ever since. But Jesus. Oh, but Jesus. Looking at the Garden of Eden, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he moves the trajectory of human beings and humanity from this separation of God, from death and sin that couldn't be covered over, a bridge is not big enough to get over that Jesus moves us to life, redemption, and restoration. He took us from a cycle of trying to be good enough to earn it, to get to the place where we had make enough good decisions that the harvest is good enough to put us back into a relationship with Jesus. But that couldn't happen. And so he made the decision to look at the cross at what he foretold was going to happen. He decided in that moment that he was going to be faithful to God in a relationship with him to move all of human history instead of the struggle with death, sin, and separation. And he was going to bring us in close because of the decision he made that night. You can't have Easter. You can't have Easter without this garden. You can't have Easter without this garden. You can't have resurrection without surrender. Also, I don't know if you've been like me with close proximity of your family, the things with our kids that we're really working on right now, as they are always kind of bound together and go from one place to another just with us as a family. As a reality, we're in close proximity with each other. And we're really trying to get them to really learn and live out this idea of sharing, that our life is to be shared. But sharing is a limited scope. It answers a problem right now. And the thing that we've been talking about with our kids is be generous. That followers of Jesus are generous with their things, with their words, with their actions, and with their time. We have a 4 and a 6-year-old, and that's hard to understand the difference between sharing and being generous. Often our days are full of tears, of screams, sad faces, and mad faces, because the reality is they're dealing with what happened in the Garden of Eden, that Adam and Eve had decided in Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, they really let it off and put us in this place where we look at life. And it says this in Genesis 3, verse 6. It says this. When a woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate it. The reality my girls are dealing with in this idea of sharing, it comes from this history and trajectory that was set by Adam and Eve, that we became people who were defined as people who take. that we decide that we are going to take what is ours, right? My girls are looking at this thing, it's like, that toy is mine. You've had it too long, now it's my turn, right? And we take and take and take, no matter the consequences that we are to bear or of any concern of other people. The reality is that we were set on a trajectory where our lives as humanity were people who take because I want it, because I need it, because I have earned it and I deserve it, and I don't care who or what happens or who has to be in the wake, that I'm going to take what is due mine. Adam and Eve set us, that my seed and my children, who are ones that take, 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 take. But Jesus decided. Jesus decided that that was not going to be our story, that that was followers of Jesus, as we're kind of teaching our kids that graciousness and the sharing, is that we as humanity, as followers of Jesus, are no longer going to be defined as people who take, but we are going to be people that give life. We give life up as a sacrifice and a gift to others, not because they deserve it, but because it was given to us by Jesus, who said, I'm going to offer myself up as an offering. And he had every right. He had every right. Every right to say, no, no, no. I'm going to take what is due mine. I have not lived a sinful life. I have done what was right with the Father. I have listened. I have obeyed. There's no way that I should have to pay for their mistakes. So I'm going to take what's mine, and I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to preserve my own life, and I'm going to take what I deserve. Jesus, who was God and is God, could say, I'm going to take life, but he decided to change in a decision that he and followers of Jesus, that his disciples who were sitting there were listening to this conversation, that he was going to be one instead who takes life, but he gives life. And he does so willingly. Not that it's going to cost him something, but he thought, and it's going to have the ultimate cost. And he didn't forsake that. He judged it. He saw it. But he said, it costs so much, but the restoration and the reconciliation and the life that I'm going to bring is the utmost important thing in this world. And so I'm going to change the trajectory of people who follow me and how they see me as not humans who take, but followers of Jesus. It's seen in the act of Jesus who give life. So we look at it. We look at the garden and we see that we cannot celebrate Easter without this moment in the garden. There cannot be resurrection without surrender to who we are and our purposes. Oh, but that word surrender. Oh, that word surrender. I mean, we see it play out on movies, sitcoms, TV series, and books, that this idea of surrender, is weak. It's weakness. It's giving up. It's giving yourself over under the thumb of a ruler because you were no longer strong and could withstand the pressure of someone else, but that you had to give up, kneel down, surrender, enshackle, imprison yourself to another person, you were a captive to an owner. And that's really what happened in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve go, all of this, but not that, that I see those things, I see that. And I remember Eve, she goes, man, that food, that apple, that tree, the fruit, oh, it looked good for food, but it was also pleasing to the eyes. And we say that my will and my feeling and understanding in my head and both my heart, I see something different than you say. I see something different than you say. And so my experience says that's good. So I don't trust you. Because I see something different, I don't trust you because I look at that and I say, that's good. I hear a word that says, wow, that's good for not only nourishment in my body, but it also of wisdom. That both I can nourish my body and have that wisdom. And it's so good. So you know what? You know what, God? My will be done, not yours. My will be done on earth and not yours. That Adam and Eve said, my will be done. I'm going to take and eat. My will, not yours, because my experience tells me that I know better than you. But Jesus, as both fully man and fully God, sits in the Garden of Eden, and he shows us, he changes us how the battle is won. He comes to say that, God, I see what is coming. I have foretold and prophesied that I will be crucified on a cross, that I will be giving my life up into the worst possible, most agonizing death. And God, if there is another way, this is your son speaking, if there is another way, is it possible that there could be something else? And if there is, please. Because he says that coming, that cup of judgment that he's going to have to drink, that cup of judgment is that when he's up on the cross, in all of humanity, sin has been laid upon him, that the God who is in relationship with the Son, and Jesus describes that the Father and I have one, is that all of humanity's sins and messed upness is going to come upon Jesus, and Jesus and the Father is going to look at Jesus, and he's going to judge him and turn his face away from his son. And that is too much for Jesus to bear. So in agony, in sweat, and in tears, he sits and he prays and he kneels down and he says, God, if there is another way, please let this cup pass. If we can do this another way, please let it pass. But he says, but your will be done. If this cup has to be drunk by me, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. He changed everything. He showed us what it's like to bear our hearts and our wills, but to come at the moment of prayer and listening and seeking the face of Jesus and to God and the Holy Spirit. And we say to him, this is my heart, but your will be done, not mine. He changed, it changed in the garden. So what do we do? What do we do if Jesus is taking us from a lifestyle and decisions that are made out of the garden and saying followers of Jesus, that Jesus changes the paradigm, shifts everything, that we as followers of Jesus are supposed to look like him? What do we go away changed and different today? How does the trajectory of our life, the purpose of our life, and the will, how does that change? Well, first, it's really easy. You have to take yourself from being defined in decisions made by the Garden of Eden, and you have to align yourself with Jesus. That you go and shift from being out of alignment with Jesus to in alignment with Jesus. And when we talk about that alignment with Jesus, it's that we come back to understand who we are and whose we are. That surrender is not a surrender to an oppressive God that is still making us pay for the mistakes that we make. No, it is bringing us back into the family that he created us to be sons and daughters of the Most High God. Then as we come back into the family, as we are aligning back, as we're welcomed back into the family, we say, I choose you, Jesus. I surrender my life to come back into alignment. It's not an oppressive, it's a freeing one, because all of the rights and responsibility that come with being a son of and a daughter of God is given to us. That our identity, our purpose, everything is laid out for us, and it allows us to be who we are. We're called and meant to be who he knows us to be. It's a freedom to say, here, come alongside of me. Listen, let me tell you who you are. And we come back in alignment with Jesus. And that takes a decision like Jesus did, and like not what Adam and Eve did, to choose to be in the family and living free as a son and daughter so that he can show you what life actually looks like as a son and daughter of the Most High God. And once you do that, once you come back into the family and you say, this is who we are as a family, this is how we live, this is what life looks like, he says, I have now taken you from being people who take to now being people who give life. That not people who take, what they deserve or what they want. But they forsake their privileges and their rights in order to give life just as Jesus did. Just as Jesus did. I love that what Paul says in Ephesians 5, he says it beautifully. He sums it up better and sometimes in more ways that I can't even think about. But it says in Ephesians 5, 1, 2, and it'll be up on the screen for you. It says this: follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love just as Christ loved us and gave himself up as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Did you catch that? We just talked about it. That as you come back into alignment, you remember that you are a children of God. And he says, as you are children of me, follow Jesus's example, who began to give life through acts of love. Acts of love. And this thing, so as we go out, instead of taking what is ours, as we are generous with our time, with our things, with our words, and our actions, as we are generous with these things, we bring the gospel that says these actions are done in love that bring life, not sin, death, and separation, but bring life, restoration, and redemption to people that we rub shoulders with in our very midst. And get this, it goes even further. It's that when you do that, when followers of Jesus decide to live like the family of God is meant to live, that we bring love just like Jesus did. We offer it freely and willingly to all people. It's a fragrant offering to God. When you go out and love your neighbor as yourself, your fragrant offering of love in giving life to them comes up, and God goes, yes. And he's pleased, just like your favorite candle when you light it and you breathe it in for the first time, you're like, oh, yes, yes. And that act of love, that giving of life, is pleasing to God, not because you do it, because it looks exactly and a lot like what Jesus did. That he remembers his son's sacrifice, and he says, my people are living in the example of Jesus and the way he lived today. But here's the thing. Aligning yourself with Jesus, aligning yourself with God, and being a people that give and not take, that's the easy part. That's the easy part. What comes in after that, if you align yourself with God, come back into the family, start to live your life, and your purpose of your life is to give love to others, then it becomes the hard part. Because what happens is you start to feel taken for granted. I'm doing all these good things, but the praise isn't being dwelt upon me. Or people are taking advantage of me. And it starts to bring seeping bitterness or seeping things in your heart that kind of move you back into what Adam and Eve says. My experience tells me something different is happening, and I am trying to live the way that my family, but I'm hearing a voice that says, do it your way, your will, not his. And that creeps in a couple ways. Maybe I need to bring it a little real for you. Maybe I need to put some handlebars on you. And these are Christian phrases that sound a lot like good biblical stuff that are really bad theology, which really bend into this place of my will. It says maybe these two things. Maybe you've kind of put them in your heart or said them before or read a bumper sticker theology. And the first one is, God is my co-pilot. That God sits next to me in the plane, and I have my hand at the wheel, and he's telling me which direction to go. But I'm in full control. Like, God is over there. Mm-hmm, thank you. Hey, buddy. Like, and I'm flying, and I'm going. But the moment that he starts to tell me to move into a place of uncertainty, of risk and anxiety and stress and maybe something that's unsafe, we look at him and say, that's why you're my co-pilot now. I'm going to turn. Right? And I'm going to turn to safety. I'm going to turn to clear skies, because what's your will instead of going through that, that ain't safe, Jesus. I ain't doing that. And so you turn, and it goes from his will to your will. Or maybe you're another one. Maybe Jesus isn't your co-pilot, but maybe you're this. Maybe Carrie Underwood did a little bad theology up in her life, and she said, "Jesus, take the wheel." Right? Like, you're still in the car, right? You're in the car. You're in the driver's seat. Jesus is in the passenger seat, and you're going towards something, and you're not saying, like, "I'm going to turn away from this. I'm going to, like, control everything." And you're saying, "Okay, Jesus, you're going to go, but Jesus, take the wheel. I'm sitting back." Right? Or not even like reaching over, but Jesus, take your student driver car, the wheel that's on your side, because you're still in the passenger seat with the brake and the gas, and you take the wheel. I'm going to be right here. You get me through that. You weather all that storm. And then once we're through, I got this. Anybody feeling that? Feeling that in this season right now, are you treating God as your co-pilot? Or someone that's taking the wheel that is in the seat next to you, and that either you're diverting the path of where God is leading you because you don't believe in your co-pilot, or you're saying, "Jesus, take the wheel, put your hand on a secondary wheel, a less wheel that doesn't have all the control, but a little bit of control, get me through that, and then I will resume command of my life." That is the temptation of your will to say, "My will be done and not yours." The reality is, y'all need to switch seats. Y'all don't only need to switch seats, but also you don't need to have a little steering wheel on your side. You need to say that, "God, I am not going to sit in the captain chair of my life because that is not my place." To put myself in subjection under you is to say, "I'm not going to sit in the command chair, but I'm going to sit in the chair next to me, and I'm going to go and participate in this journey where you lead me through whatever storm." And so maybe you're saying, like, "That is my worst nightmare because right now I have control of very little in my life. And I want to be in the seat. I want to be in the seat and I want to control whatever thing I can control. If I can't miss, if I don't have to go through the full part of the storm, but I can go over the side part of the storm, I'm going to do that." But what if looking into the garden to say, "Your will be done. Your will be done, even if it is through the storm." That Jesus, taking the example of Jesus, saying, "It is going to the worst possible place. The worst possible place that I can imagine, but your will be done, because when I'm at the center of your will, when you are in control of all things, that is the safest place to be." That's what it looks like to be people of resurrection who surrender all things to say, "I don't need to be in control because I have a God who is actually in control of all things, and that I don't need me to touch anything because I'm going to mess it up. I'm going to be part of the journey, and God's going to use me. He's going to show me where to go. We're going to make a pit stop, and I'm going to do incredible acts of love, but I'm going to get back in the car, and if it's going to a place that I don't want to go, I'm going to pour my heart out. But at the same time, I'm going to say, 'Your will be done. Take me there.'" How many of you need to know that Jesus, God, is in absolute control, and he's asking you to get out of the car and out of the captain chair, because where you're going and what you're doing, you're messing it up. That Jesus is actually the one that can make things better, even if it is in dangerous, treacherous path in your life, that you have the one who created all things and all things are under him and nothing works outside of him. He is the one that is leading your path. You can't celebrate Easter. We can't head to Easter and be like, "Yes, Jesus is risen," without the garden that says, "I'm going to be a people of resurrection, but I'm also going to surrender my life in alignment with him, loving people, giving life, and allowing him in to be the chair that he is supposed to be in, and take myself out of that seat." This is what the garden, this is the tale of two gardens, that God is changing everything from the way that we acted and lived in the Garden of Eden and saying, "Be my people of the garden, be resurrected people of the garden who both live in full hope and satisfaction and anticipation of Jesus returning, but I'm gonna surrender until it happens." This is where it flows. This is where anxiety is stripped. Fear is no more, because we sit in a chair where we don't have to control things. And we become at ease that we know of a God who is in control of all things and knows what's best and has our best interest at heart, even if it is suffering, because he had it for his son. Let us pray.